Let's go ahead and get started on another week of our 4.5 year verse by verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We're going to open to 2 Kings chapter 3 as our starting point today. Now, the timing of these events is this. King Ahab, the king of northern Israel, had been killed in battle in 863 BC. I believe that's the correct timing for that. And he was replaced by his son Ahaziah. Now, Ahaziah did not last terribly long on the throne. He ends up falling through a lattice work in his upper chamber, gets a mortal wound, and gets chewed out at the very end of his life by the prophet Elijah for trying to seek out Baal's help in his injury rather than the help of the true and living God. So when King Ahaziah died, his brother, a younger brother, Jehoram, next came to the throne. And that is going to happen in 862 BC, which is where we begin today. Chapter 3, 2 Kings, verse 1. In the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 12 years. So he's going to be on the throne longer than his older brother. But he has issues just like his older brother, just not as bad, if you will. Verse 2. He did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, though not like his father and mother, for he put away the pillar of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he clung to the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. He did not depart from it. So mom and dad, Ahab and Jezebel, had tried to replace the worship of He Who Is in northern Israel with the worship of Baal and Asherah. My guess is that in the minds of many northern Israelis, Baal and Yahweh, He Who Is, were actually just the same names for the same God. And when this was insisted upon by Queen Jezebel, who was a Sidonian princess who came to this northern kingdom, they just simply turned everything over to the worship of Baal, assuming that they were just using a different name for the true and living God. Well, when Jehoram comes to the throne, he decides to backtrack on that. He decides they're not going to be worshiping Baal, the thunder and lightning god of the Canaanites. They're not going to be worshiping Asherah, the mother goddess, the queen of heaven, the fertility goddess. They are instead going to go back to the original worship of the northern kingdom, Jeroboam. And that would be the golden calves that were supposed to represent He Who Is, that brought them out of Egypt. One of those calves was originally put at Bethel, and the other put at Dan. So Jehoram backtracks away from Baal worship, but unfortunately he doesn't backtrack far enough to the true worship of God, and instead settles for the worship of the golden calves of Jeroboam. So that's why he's not as bad as his parents and brother, but he's still as bad as Jeroboam. Verse number 4. We've known some of this information in verses 4 and 5 already, but because it is now time to do something about it, it gets refreshed in our heads. Verse 4. Now Misha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder. And he had to deliver to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. At some point during Ahab's reign, the kingdom of Moab, which is on the east side of the Dead Sea, is the kingdom of Moab is a little bit south of the eastern portion of northern Israel. I hope that's not too many directional names to throw you off too much. But basically, Moab was on the southern border of eastern northern Israel. And Ahab had apparently entered into some sort of tributary arrangement that Moab had to provide 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams every single year. Now, we know that when Ahab was killed in battle, the kingdom of Moab immediately decided they would not be under Israel's boot anymore. But it wasn't until the next calendar year, the one that we're looking at right here, 862 BC, when Jehoram is the king, that the tribute wasn't paid. Because remember, the older son, Ahaziah, was not on the throne very long. He was only on the throne less than a whole year, just parts of two calendar years. So the tribute has not been paid. Verse 8, when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So Jehoram marched out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. So Jehoram has decided, I'm going to take this problem and fix it by forcing Moab back under its tributary role to the northern kingdom of Israel. But he decides that he would benefit from an alliance with his other southern neighbor, that would be the kingdom of Judah. So, verse 7, he went and sent word to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And here's his message. The king of Moab has rebelled against me. That is, he hasn't paid his tribute this year. Will you go with me to battle against Moab? Now, this sets up an interesting scenario for us, because we know that Jehoshaphat was chewed out by God for entering into a military alliance with Ahab the year previous in trying to take back Ramoth-Gilead for the northern kingdom. He evidently repented of that, almost got him killed, but he repented of it. Then, when the new king of northern Israel came to power, Ahaziah, Jehoshaphat got involved in a trade agreement with him that they were going to build ships on the north coast of the Gulf of Aqaba and resume trade routes into the Indian Ocean, either to Southeast Africa or the Indian subcontinent. Well, God didn't like that arrangement either and sent nasty storms that destroyed the shipbuilding projects and basically told Jehoshaphat, knock it off, quit cooperating with the northern kingdom. Well, here he is with a third request that he enter into an alliance with a king from northern Israel. Now, it is a new person who has repudiated the worship of Baal and Asherah. And so I think the fact that it's a new person with that repudiation of pagan worship, Jehoshaphat thinks it's worth his efforts to enter into an alliance with this new man. We are pretty certain that Jehoshaphat was hoping that the two kingdoms could come together through his efforts, because he's married his own son, the crown prince, to the princess of the northern kingdom, which means there's a potential of a child, a son born from that marriage, becoming the prince or the king over both kingdoms. Well, let's see what Jehoshaphat does. Verse number 7 continues. He said, I will go. I am as you are. Your people are my people are your people. My horses are your horses. Now, interestingly enough, that's exactly the same thing that he said to Ahab. So he has apparently not learned his lessons, or maybe he's making these excuses that this is a new guy and maybe God would be okay with this one. So the next thing we have is Jehoshaphat asking about how this is going to happen. What's the plan? Then he said, by which way shall we march? Jehoram answered, by the way of the wilderness of Edom. So Jehoram, who's already come one day's travel from Samaria to Jerusalem, recommends that they travel another couple, maybe 3 days, south, past the southern end of the Dead Sea, and into the territory of Edom, which is a tributary to the southern kingdom of Judah, and pick up some more military forces there, and then sweep around and attack Moab from the south, perhaps the southwest. Verse number 9. So the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. So we've got three kings together. And when they had made a circuitous route or march of 7 days, and let me explain what I think we're talking about here. As I already said, there's at least one day's travel from Samaria down to Jerusalem. Then we've got the meeting between the two kings and the logistical arrangements for their two armies to be mustered together. Then that would take another 2 or 3 days to get from Jerusalem down to Edom, where they're going to pick up another king and another army. So probably another logistical day. Plus, there needs to be a Sabbath rest somewhere in the middle of those 7 days. Because Jehoshaphat is a very religious person. And so he would have wanted his army of Judah to have a Sabbath rest. So that's probably the 7 days that we're talking about. And they arrive somewhere around the border between Edom and Moab, which is, it varies at different times in history, but let's call it the Wadi Zered, which flows from the east down into the very southeastern corner of the Dead Sea of that time. So they arrive somewhere along that area, probably at the southeast corner of the Dead Sea. And here's what it says. There was no water for the army or for the animals that followed them. So it's in the dry season. So we're probably in the summertime when there is no rain and everything starts drying out. But it's apparently really bad in this particular year. So the king of Israel, that's Jehoram, said, alas, he who is has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. So Jehoram makes this assumption that God is doing this to them, that he has somehow pulled all these strings to bring them out into this very dry place and let them all die of dehydration, die of thirst, and be attacked by the Moabite armies in that sort of condition. Well, Jehoshaphat is not on board with that belief. So Jehoshaphat said, is there no prophet of he who is here through whom we may inquire of he who is? So Jehoshaphat is, instead of blaming God, why don't we check in with God? Which I'm going to jump in and say, that would have been a good thing for Jehoshaphat to have done several days ago when they were still at Jerusalem, when Jehoram had asked him to join in this military venture. I think it would have been so much better if he had simply stopped then and gone to one of the prophets of he who is at Jerusalem and said, should I be going on this trip? Should I be engaging in this military alliance? Because the answer would have been no. He was not supposed to be out there. But better late than never, I guess. So one of the king of Israel's servants answered, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah. Now let's go back to their story. Elijah was the big name prophet in northern Israel. He was probably well known to the people in Judah as well, but his ministry area was northern Israel. His protege for the last several years has been Elisha. Well, not very long before this little military foray takes place, Elijah disappeared from planet Earth in a fiery whirlwind. And Elisha has now become the big head prophet in the northern kingdom of Israel, which is probably why he shadowed the Israeli army as they went south. Well, the moment that Jehoshaphat finds out that Elisha is in the encampment, he knows that this is a source of genuine prophecy. Verse 12, Jehoshaphat said, the word of he who is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. Elisha said to the king of Israel, what have I to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and to the prophets of your mother. So Elisha responds to this new king of Israel by basically telling him, why do you want to ask me any questions? Why don't you go talk to Baal? Go talk to Asherah, the god and goddess that your mom and dad, Ahab and Jezebel, were in so much in love with. Well, the king of Israel said to him, no, it is he who has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. So he goes back to this idea that we are doing this in the name of he who is. Now, keep in mind, Jehoram has repudiated Baal worship. He's repudiated Asherah worship. He is trying to worship he who is by means of the golden calves of Jeroboam. Now, he's wrong in doing that, but he actually believes that he is trying to be faithful to the God of Israel's history, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the God who brought them out of Egypt and put them in the promised land. So his response is, I'm not going to go to the prophets of Baal. I'm not going to go to the prophets of Asherah. I want answers from he who is, who apparently wants us all to die of thirst out here. So there is an accusation being made. Verse 14. Elisha said, as he who is of the armies lives, before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you. So Elisha's status or standard is this: the only reason I'm going to pass on to you the word of the Lord is because we actually have a true believer here in this encampment, and that's Jehoshaphat. And so he gets God's word. It's interesting how God's word is presented. Verse 15, but now bring me a musician. And when the musician played, the hand of he who is came upon him. One of the things that we find a little odd in our modern context is that prophets often sung their prophecies. David was considered a prophet. And the prophets of his time period, maybe many of them not so well known, sung their prophecies or sang their prophecies. So Elisha has a message to deliver, but he's going to deliver it accompanied by music, because music is a powerful delivery system, which is why all of us ought to have good, solid, Bible-based songs that we use in our worship services and in our private devotional life as well. So verse number 16, he said, "Thus says he who is, I will make this dry stream bed full of pools." Now, in my estimation, they are probably encamped on the Wadi Zered, where it dumps onto the flatland on the southeast corner of the Dead Sea. That's where I think they're actually encamped right now. And so what happens is the Wadi Zered, when it dumps into that area, it makes little pools of water that will eventually evaporate during the dry season. Well, none of that water is anywhere there now. It's all gone. So he is prophesying that there's going to be water in this exact place very soon. Verse 17, "For thus says he who is, you shall not see wind or rain, but that stream bed shall be filled with water so that you shall drink, you, your livestock, and your animals. This is a light thing in the sight of he who is. He will also give the Moabites into your hand, and you shall attack every fortified city, every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop up all springs of water, and ruin every good piece of land with stones." Now, it is evident here that judgment of God is being placed upon the nation of Moab, upon the kingdom of Moab, because of their sinful worship of the destroyer king, Molech Chemosh. And so judgment of God is going to be carried out against the Moabites. And the miracle that is going to be given here is that rain is going to fall far, far, far upstream, so that there will be no rainstorm where these guys are at, but all the water is going to fall and come to them exactly as needed. And once they get their fill of water, they are then to carry out God's judgment against Moab. Verse 20, "The next morning, about the time of the offering of the sacrifice," so that'd be about 9 a.m., "behold, water came from the direction of Edom till the country was filled with water." So the Wadi Zered starts draining off rainwater from way, way, many, many, many miles upstream, off to the southeast. And that water arrives and starts filling up all the pools in this flat land that I believe they're encamped by on the southeast corner of the Dead Sea. And so they get the water they need. However, verse 21 says, "When all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to put on armor, from the youngest to the oldest, were called out and were drawn up at the border." So that goes back to the days previous. Scouts knew that the combined armies were coming up toward them from the southwest. And so they get together and they arrive just exactly at the same time at the border region here. And this is what they think they see. Verse 22, "When they rose early in the morning and the sun shone on the water, the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood." So they're coming toward this flatland from a little bit higher altitude. And from a distance, they see what looks like red liquid laying all over the flatlands down there below them. And since there hasn't been any rain, it's the dry season, they assume something that's not true. Verse 23, they said, "Well, this is blood. The kings have surely fought together and they struck one another down. Now then, Moab, to the spoil." So they assume that the three kings got into a fight fought each other, and there's nothing but dead and dying soldiers down there in all that blood. But they're wrong. It's the sun, the early morning sun, the 9 a.m. sun, shining off of all that water and making this optical illusion. Verse 24, when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelis rose and struck the Moabites till they fled before them, and they went forward striking the Moabites as they went. So it basically turns into an ambush. And then they did exactly what God had told them to. They overthrew the cities of the Moabites, and on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. That's disrupting the agricultural cycle. They stopped every spring of water and felled all the good trees till only its stones were left at Kir Hareseth. Now that's kind of their main city down in southern Moab. And the slingers surrounded and attacked it. So now they've got the Moabites trapped in their main city. When the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but they could not. And then he took his oldest son, who was to reign in his place, and offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. Now remember, the Moabites worship Chemosh Molech. And one of the ways they worship him is by intentionally getting women pregnant and then burning up the children of those relationships as sacrifices to their god. Well, this king decides, I have to give up my crown prince in that sort of sacrifice for Chemosh Molech to save me. Well, this just really upsets the attacking armies, particularly the Israelis. And it says, there came great wrath against Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. So the northern kingdom of Israel gives up on their attempt to bring Moab back under their boot because of this atrocity that they see happen right in front of their eyes.